As promised, we're joined right now by a Sports Illustrated executive editor and a senior writer, a contributing correspondent for 60 Minutes, a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book, Glory Days, the Summer of 1984 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever, comes out tomorrow. John Wertheim is my guest. John, good to have you back. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Jim?
Good, good. John, really interesting book, and I'm eager to talk to you about this. There are a lot of different places we could start, but I want to start with the fact that the advance praise for the book comes from a lot of respected authors and media outlets, but also from one Ralph Macchio, which is awesome. What does it mean to receive love from the Karate Kid for your work?
Once you have Ralph Macchio's literary blessing, it's all downhill. But no, seriously, he was a great... He was great to talk to. He couldn't have been cooler. He was really good on, there's a Karate Kid chapter and he has a lot of details, but he also was really good just with other thoughts on what made that summer so special. He was great.
All right. So John, before we start diving in, you were 13 in 1984. So when you personally think back about that summer, what are the strongest memories that come to your mind?
Yeah, I mean, the story is that I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, and in the summer of 84, the Olympic team trained there because Bob Knight was the coach, and it was, you know, a sleepy college town in the middle of Indiana, and you'd be bored, so you'd go to the gym to watch Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley, you know, Patrick Ewing, and John Stockton practice, and I wrote about it for Sports Illustrated, and that was sort of the jumping-off point for this whole book was, you know, man, it was a while ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And man, were sports in a different time when you know, Michael Jordan was wandering around my town hoping somebody would drive him to the mall or, you know, take him to play putt-putt. We've come a long way in a pretty short amount of time.
I mean, that's crazy. Like, so how would you describe, I mean, you started to right there, but how would you describe Jordan back in 1984? And you saw him out and about one point. What happened?
Yeah, I saw him all the time. I mean, again, it's a little town, even when the students are there. When students aren't there, it's a ghost town. And I'd see him, and I'd walk around with my, you know, I was a sports nerd and would have my tennis rackets, and he'd call me John McEnroe. And, I just remember how absolutely cool he was. But I also remember sort of, you know, this was kind of a happy-go-lucky, maybe a little bit of a lonely kid. He had just decided to turn pro. I mean, he wanted to go back to UNC and play his senior year with Kenny Smith as his point guard, and Dean Smith basically said, you got to go to the NBA. I think one of the themes of the book, you know, Jordan started that summer as a sort of sheepish kid, and he ends it with a gold medal. He's the third pick in the draft. David Fox got him this crazy Nike deal where he doesn't just get a shoe and a poster, but he even gets his own signature design. And the same way Jordan started that summer in a very different place to where he ended up, that was kind of the theme of the book, that sports was in a very different place in May of 1984 than it was in by Labor Day.
This book is called Glory Days, the Summer of 1984 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. The book comes out tomorrow. You know, John, I could talk to you this entire conversation about Jordan that summer, but there's so much more to it. For instance, what did Bobby Knight think of Michael Jordan at that time?
Yeah, for all his flaws, Bobby Knight was right on point with Jordan. And he was friends with Stu Inman, who was the GM of the Trailblazers. And they said, who are you thinking of drafting? Oh, we need a center, and this kid Sam Bowie's pretty good. And Knight said, I'm telling you, take Jordan. They said, well, we got Clyde Drexler, and you know, we got Jim Paxson. We don't need the swing. And Knight said, he is the best basketball player I've ever seen. Not potentially. I'm saying right now he is the best player. Draft Jordan. Play him at center if you have to. The Blazers didn't, but for whatever Bob Knight's flaws may have been, he was really he nailed Jordan from the first time he practiced with him at those Olympic trials.
John Wertheim is my guest. So, John, 1984 was also the first meeting of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson in the NBA Finals. How significant a moment was that for the NBA, and then how did that set the stage for the next few decades for the league?
Yeah, it was also the first few months on the job for this new commissioner who'd been a lawyer and took over for Larry O'Brien. This guy, David Stern, takes over the job, and he's on the job a few weeks, and he gets a Game 7 with Bird and Magic. My favorite story from that series was they flew coach back then, and you know the veterans sat in business, and everyone else sat in coach, and Pat Riley really wanted to get back to Boston fast for game seven. So the Lakers not only flew coach to game seven, biggest game of their season, you know, the decisive game, but they took a red eye and they couldn't get a direct flight. So they flew through Washington, D.C.
Insane.
This sets the stage. I mean, imagine you're David Stern. You get this job. You're the commissioner. You're trying to do all sorts of different things. And this league was really the fourth of the big four. I mean, even in teams where there were hockey teams and NBA teams, the hockey teams outgrew the NBA teams. And you're David Stern. You're a few weeks on the job. You get game seven. You get bird magic. And then, like, 9 days after that, you get a draft where Michael Jordan goes third and, you know, Barkley goes fifth. It's the NBA pre-84 and post-84 is a completely different business.
Right. I'm jumping around a little bit here, but also in 1984, you've got the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, and I remember that pretty distinctly because I worked those games, John, when I was still at UC Santa Barbara, so there was a venue up in Santa Barbara, so I did work those games too. For those who do not remember, which city was the other finalist, well, sort of, when LA won the right to host the games, and how significant was it that Los Angeles was the host that summer?
Exactly. I mean, so 76 is in Montreal, and it's fine, but they lose a ton of money. You know, 72, you had the Israeli athletes massacred in Germany. In 80, there was a boycott. No one wants these Olympics. L.A. had to beat out Tehran, the capital of Iran, to get the 1984 Olympics. And then, the government was overthrown, and Tehran withdrew their bid. So L.A. pretty much got the 84 games by default. And this guy no one had heard of, Peter Ueberroth, says, we got to start running this like a business. We got to pit these networks against each other for contracts. We got to really go nuts on these sponsorships. We got to have fewer of them, but we've got to have them worth more money. And, I would say that the 1980 games in Lake Placid, there were about $10 million in sponsorships. The first deal Ueberroth signed in L.A. was with Coke. It was $12 million. So with one deal, he did more than the entire sponsorship of the previous games in North America, and the LA games end up making a profit of $250 million. I didn't realize this. So one of my favorite stories of this was a lot of that money was reinvested in LA sports. So, Russell Westbrook ends up playing basketball on a court that was sponsored by the surplus from the 84 games. The Venus and Serena Williams were in a tennis program, and that was sponsored by 84 game surplus. And then after 84, obviously, we're in a completely different world with the Olympics, getting to the point where you would hold the games despite a pandemic in 2021. But, I mean, if you look at the Olympics as a money-making operation, and you look at broadcast and sponsorship rights, and it really starts in L.A. in 84.
We are talking about a brand new book. It's called Glory Days. It's coming out tomorrow. John Wertheim is my guest. And again, John, I'm jumping around because there's so much in this book. It's not even just about sports. Then you've got some of the pop culture. Like, the sports memories are pretty obvious, but also from that summer, you had Springsteen's Born in the USA. You had Prince's Purple Rain. From a music standpoint, how significant was the summer of 84?
Some of it is if you go back and you look and sort of albums came out on Fridays. And it literally was like, Purple Rain one day, Ghostbusters soundtrack the next Friday, and the Friday after that, Born in the USA. But, I mean, the other thing that was going on in terms of music was you had this network, MTV, that was doing something crazy and not just playing music, but actually having a video to go with it. It was like a little movie. And it was a great business model where MTV didn't pay for the videos. The labels and the artists had to deliver them. But 84 was really when you had this explosion of cable, and something that really helped pop music was you didn't just hear you didn't just hear Bruce Springsteen, but you saw him and he invites the woman out of the front row to dance with him to Dancing in the Dark. That was Courtney Cox, a little trivia. But the fact that you had this visual component to music completely changed the rock industry in the mid 80s too.
Now, I remember seeing him on that tour. I went to the L.A. Coliseum and sat at the very top, and I'll never forget what that was like. Let me just go back really quickly to the Olympic Games. Part of the 84 games were about technology. There were computers, there were pagers, and more. John, I've told my staff this story, but it's really funny. I used to jump on those computer terminals before we even knew what they were, and I was trying to reach out to people. And again, I was in Santa Barbara, so I'm trying to reach out to people like Howard Cosell and Jim Lampley. If I'm not mistaken, I think when I said something to the effect of like, hey, Howard, my name is Jim Rome, and I blah, 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 blah. I would love to meet you for a cup of coffee. I think he corrected my grammar and told me to leave him alone. But it was just so amazing that we could actually use that technology to reach out to other people. How big of a role did technology play in the summer games of 84?
Yeah, I mean, again, before 84, they were like measuring, you know, the javelin throws with a tape measure. And all of a sudden, they've got technology and IBM and AT&T are sponsors. But what you were talking about, it's really funny to go hear the stories. Jay Billis was also, you know, same about like your age. He was a college kid that was in L.A. working at the Olympics, and they gave what I think they called an EMS, electronic messaging system. And they were literally like, you don't have to pick up a phone to talk to someone. You can do it electronically and send them a message. Howard Cosell, I'm impressed, because most people did not actually activate their password. But basically, this system that you used and got a response from Howard Cosell. That's a great story.
Well, let me tell you something, man. I went with an email blast before there were emails. I was like hitting everybody up.
Exactly.
Yeah, I had to, right? So, but how do you explain this then? Finally, with everything that was going on across sports, music, entertainment, and more, and it all happened in the same summer. Is it a coincidence, or was there something that happened that led up to all of that and this perfect storm?
Oh, man, that's a great question, because some of this is just, you know, whatever. It's a wild coincidence that, you know, Donald Trump buys the USFL the same summer that, you know, Mike Tyson starts. I think the one unifying theme, I think, is cable TV. And David Stern saw it, and Vince McMahon saw it, and to some extent, Uber saw it. And you had this whole universe where now you had another way to expose your product to the world. You know, it's like MTV and the videos. You had another way to get revenue. You had another way to sort of channel your product and the cable. You know, this was a summer where ESPN was sold to ABC and realized that they didn't have to pay the cable systems. The cable systems ought to pay them. And I think the sort of one unifying theme is this was the summer of cable. And for sports, you know, I don't know, we see it today, 37 years later, it's still kind of propping up the enterprise. But I think the more I didn't know this when I started the project, but as I started to do the research, it became pretty clear that cable was one of the huge reasons that this was such a pivotal summer for sports.
You know what's crazy, John? You just said it 37 years later. It's been 37 years since this.
You're singing my song. I know,
man.
Crazy.
I know. I'm not helping him either by bringing that up, but that is amazing. He is a Sports Illustrated executive editor. He is a senior writer. He is a contributing correspondent for 60 Minutes, and this is really a fascinating book. It's called Glory Days, the Summer of 1984, the 90 Days that Changed Sports and Culture Forever. The book comes out tomorrow. John, great to have you back. Thanks so much. Really enjoyed that, as always.
Oh, thanks, as always. Thanks as always, Jim.
Take care, John. Be good. He is an excellent, excellent journo. One of the best in the business.